I miss a green, for example, I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of the Fried Egg Podcast. With us this morning, bright and early in Florida here, and late at night in Australia, is Michael Clayton. Michael had a long playing career. He was a professional on both the Australian and European tours. He won a few times, and he has now become one of the game's preeminent golf course architects. With his firm of OCCM. So, Michael, thanks for coming on.
Thank you, Andy. I look forward to it.
Yeah, I think it would be great if you could tell us a little bit about your background, how you got into golf, and so the reader or the listeners that don't know a ton about you can get a little info on you.
Well, I grew up in Melbourne, which is the best city to play golf in Australia, as well as sandbelt courses. But I grew up on the other side of the city from the sandbelt, really. My parents bought a house at the back of a place called Eastern Golf Club, which is now being dug up for housing. They're in the midst of cutting roads through it and building houses on it. But I jumped the fence and started to caddy, and then I just started to play. And, I got kind of went through the system there, I suppose, playing schoolboy golf and junior golf and amateur golf. And Peter Thompson was from here, so I spent a lot of time watching him play. And my interest in design, I suppose, was, I grew up watching golf and playing golf a bit at Royal Melbourne and Kingston Heath and Metropolitan and Victoria, so all the great courses on the sandbelt. So it was really how I got to where I am now, I suppose. But I started as a caddy, and I played, and I loved to play. It was like, I guess you meet kids the same age, and you just play golf all day every day, so that was what we did.
Yeah, sounds a lot like my childhood. I feel like for somebody, everybody kind of has like an architectural enlightening when they play like a really, really great golf course, when you see like, this is what golf is supposed to be like. Do you feel like that is kind of the case with you?
Yeah, I think I watched tournaments at Royal Melbourne before I played there. So I was aware that it was a really good golf course. I wasn't probably aware quite how good, but I started playing there in the early, mid-70s, I suppose. I watched tournaments there in the early, the World Cup was there in 1972. So I guess you instinctively know that it's a good course. You read about it being a good course, and golfers would come out, Gary Player and Tom Weisskopf played that World Cup, and they would come out and say what a great golf course it was. And you kind of, I suppose you're aware that it's a special place, and then I watched Gary Player play at Kingston Heath in 1970, and so you're just around good golf. Most cities in Australia have one or two or three or four good courses, really good courses, but Melbourne's got Melbourne and the Mornington Peninsula probably has 15 or 20. So it's really the centre of golf in Australia, really. So I was lucky enough to grow up in the middle of it.
It's interesting. Australia and Melbourne, like on my short list for places to visit to, just go on a, golf binge. How would you, having traveled the world and, played so many of the great courses, how would you compare Melbourne to say like a, New York and Long Island, or, a Scotland and Ireland, like in terms of concentration of, you know, one of those, you know, metro areas?
Well, the place I know best was London, because I played in Europe for 15 years and I lived, we had a house about 10 minutes down the road from Sunningdale for 8 years. So that's the concentration of courses I know best. Mm-hmm. So if you threw the Heathland courses together with the Sandbelt, I think Royal Melbourne's the best course of anything. Mm-hmm. And then Kingston Heath on a par with the old courses, Sunningdale probably. But then if you ran out the next 10, I think you'd probably, they'd nearly all be the Heathland courses. Mm-hmm. So in terms of a concentration of golf, I would, you know, I think London's probably better. I mean, Swindley Forest and Sunningdale and Walton Heath, the Berkshire, Woking. There's so many tremendous courses over there. You know, I wonder if it's a bit of a case of familiarity breeding a bit of contempt in Australia, because I know them so well. But you know, as a concentration of courses, I think London's pretty much unmatched. I've played a little bit in New York. I mean, the National and Maidstone and Friars Head and Shinnecock, and seen those courses up there, but not so much in the city. But I mean, Pine Valley, Merion, I suppose, are quite a way away from New York. But for me, I always thought London was an amazing place to play golf. And not so far away, it's a place that people don't give any credit to, but Paris has got some fantastic golf, Saint-Germain, Fontainebleau, Montfontaine, Chantilly. So there are some tremendous courses in Paris. And as a country, I think England is an extraordinary variety of golf courses, great links courses, the Heathland courses. I mean, places like Notts and Ganton and Paul Woodley, there's an amazing variety of golf in England in such a small space, really. I mean, compared with Australia and the United States, it's a tiny country, and you can kind of whip through England in sort of 6 or 8 weeks and play tremendous golf from the, you know, the southwest corner up to the northeast. It's an amazing country for golf.
Yeah, I just need to convince the fiance that I need a 6 to 8 week work trip, right? Out in England.
Well, you can come to Melbourne for a couple of weeks and do Melbourne and Tasmania, which is really becoming the centre of great public course golf in Australia, with two new courses on King Island and two courses at Bunbury. Mm-hmm. So Tasmania is really taking off as a great, you know, a bit like Bandon and Cabot Links and Sam Valley. Mike Kaiser's kind of remote golf in America. It's Tasmania's become a bit sort of that model in Australia, where they're building courses on places that they're not hard to get to, but you've got to make an effort to get to them, and people are finding great land and building great golf, which is a good thing for the game down here.
Mm-hmm. You guys have a project out there, correct?
Well, we've got a maybe project in Hobart. Okay. There's a tremendous bit of land on a spit of land. Really, it's a sand dunes and pine trees with water on three sides, 10 minutes from Hobart Airport. So Hobart's a decent-sized city. It might be the 5th or 6th or 7th biggest city in Australia. It's the capital of Tasmania, but I think that's more than likely to happen. So that's potentially a great project for us, yeah.
That'd be cool. It's there's so much good golf in the world that... So, I want to transition here into your playing career. You know, kind of came up through the Australian ranks as a great amateur player, and you hit the European Tour in professional golf kind of in the 80s. You got with the European Tour and Australian Tour, travel the world and play some of the greatest places. But tell us a little bit about what life on the European Tour was like in that time. And, a little bit about your playing career.
Well, when I first started, it was top 60 were exempt. So you just went over there and you played Mondays. And if you made the cut, you kept going. So there was no way to plan what you were going to do like you can now. I mean, at the start of the year, you pretty much know now what you're in and what you're not. But over there, it was a matter of making the cut and playing, and if you missed it, you went back to Monday. So It wasn't much fun at the time, but you know, I think it was a good system because I think if you kept playing well, you could keep going and make the cut that way. So I played a few tournaments in 82. Then I just missed the top 60 in my first full year, and then I won a tournament early the next year, so I was kind of exempt the rest of my time. And then they went to a top 125 system in 1985. But back then, the tour really started in April and finished up in, we would come home in the middle of September. I mean, now obviously it goes all year because they did what was the obvious thing, and they got outside of continental Europe and went to South Africa and the Middle East and now Australia and Asia. And so it's really become the world tour. Not the world tour, but a world tour. It was a time when I think, you know, the greatest privilege really was to play with Seve, you know, in his time. Because, I mean, for me, he was the best player ever to watch play golf. He wasn't the best player, I don't think. I mean, you know, Nicklaus and Tiger and those guys were clearly better players. But to watch someone play golf, there was no one like that. He was the most charismatic, and it's an overused word, but I adored watching him play golf. He could hit incredible shots. He was great fun to watch. He was incredible theatre. So I think all of his contemporaries, I mean, you know, the lower ranked players like we all were, sort of were in awe of how he played. But I think too, you know, if you spoke to Faldo or Langer or Sandy Lyle or Woozy or, you know, his real contemporaries, they would all tell you that he was the main man, and you know he was the first European to show that they could compete in America and play in America and win the Masters and win the Open Championship. And so, you know, playing in his time was really incredible. I don't think there's anyone since who's, I mean, Roy's, you know, his own man and great to watch in his own way, but I don't think they'll ever be able. Well, I suppose Palmer, I saw Palmer play when he was an old man really in the Open. And, or when I say old, I saw him play in the Open at Muirfield in 87. And he played down here in Australia. He played at my club at Metropolitan in 1978. But, you know, for me, Seve was the guy to watch. He was incredible, really, I thought.
Do you feel like in a certain way, I really think, like, I think back to my childhood, and unfortunately I'm too young to have, like, you know, really seen prime Seve. But, you know, Tiger Woods was, you know, the guy that led to, you know, kind of my generation and this golf explosion. Do you feel like Seve kind of had that effect on the world and in Europe especially, where, you know, he got, you know, kind of led a surge in, you know, popularity of golf within, like, you know, younger generations?
Well, he said it did in Europe. I mean, he brought that tour to life, really. It was a pretty staid tour, really centered around England. I mean, probably half the tournaments were in England. And, I mean, Tony Jackman was the big star, but he'd really gone to America, and Who's to Who's went to America. So it was, you know, in the 70s, it was really, I mean, Bob Shearer and Jack Newton and Bobby Cole and I mean, they were the big stars of the European tour until Seve really came on the scene in 1975. That was his first full year. And he really carried that tour from then until, you know, he lost his game, really, you know, in the mid-90s. And, of course, the difference between then and now is that he didn't just up and leave and go and live in Florida and play golf in America. I mean, none of the leading Europeans really play in Europe anymore. They play a few tournaments there, but I mean, Seve played the European Tour, which was his big fight with Beamon, was that Dean Beamon wanted him to play 15 tournaments in America when he was committed to playing, you know, 15 or 18 tournaments in Europe, and he played in Australia and Japan. And I mean, it was a ridiculous expectation that, well, you have to play 15 tournaments in America as well. So that fight he had with Beamon was really, you know, crazy that, you know, what they were asking him to do. But he carried that tour for, he made that tour and carried it for 15 years. So he was certainly, a significant player in that sense. And I think he gave, I mean, my generation had grown up, every superstar in golf was American. I mean, apart from Jack and Willie, who won the Open and the US Open in the 69 and 70, I mean, Nicklaus and Watson and Miller and Weisskopf and Trevino and, well, I suppose Gary Player was, the foreign superstar, really. But, I mean, almost every big star in golf was American. And finally, he was a player from an unusual part of the world who showed his generation that they too could be, the preserve of the top of the game wasn't solely with Americans.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think like all the great American players are, nowadays are, you see a different type of player, and thinking about it now is like, Seve probably led to a somewhat of a Spain like revival of golf. You see there are a lot of world class Spanish players now on the European tour with Garcia, Rafa Cabrera Bello, Pablo Lazarbel, and then you got John Rahm coming up through the ranks, and I have to imagine a lot of that had to do with Seve's impact on the game and his popularity.
Well, it did, but I mean Seve was, I mean already when he came out there was, I mean Canizares and Pinero and Garrido who were all kind of Madrid-based caddies. I mean, they're already good Spanish players, and I mean, Seve's brother was a good player. Uh-huh. And Mo was a decent player on the European Tour. So, Seve came out, and they all knew he was the big star. But I mean, Spain always had good players. It's that Latin kind of flair for playing the game, which was shared with DiVincenzo and sort of later Eduardo Romero and Vicente Fernandez and Angel Cabrera, who, they play the game much differently than everyone else. They play with great flair and touch, and whilst they certainly didn't have bad methods, they certainly weren't as analytical as Australians or South Africans or Americans tend to be about golf and trying to perfect the golf swing. They played in a way that reflected their character. Mm-hmm. Well, the character of their countries, really. I mean, much more easygoing and less trying to analyse things to death and just go and play with passion and flair and get the ball in the hole. And I mean, Seve was the best at it. But, I mean, I saw DiVincenzo play when he was, he was an old man. He was younger than I am now, but he was sort of 57 when I saw him play at Fulford in 1980. And, wow, he was still a great player. He was a pro in his late 50s. He was a tremendous player. And Eduardo Romero was a beautiful player, and Cabrera was, tremendous players to watch. So you can lump the South American players and the Spanish players all in together, really, in terms of how they played the game.
It's interesting. So who, I always ask this question with architecture, but in terms of kind of European tour, like who's the best player that most Americans never heard of? That was on the European tour in like the 80s.
He was older then, but Neil Coles was, I think. I mean, Neil Coles was a tremendous player. He hated to fly. He was on that bad Ryder Cup flight that flew into Palm Springs. It was apparently a wicked flight. Turbulence. He didn't fly much after that. But Neil Coles was a fantastic player. He was second in the Open to Weisskopf, tied with Miller in 73, and I mean, he won a lot of tournaments in Europe and was a great player, really. So probably Neil Coles. I mean, he was a beautiful golfer, I thought.
Mm-hmm. If you're a player on the European tour and you don't like to fly, you're kind of in a tough bind.
Well, you can drive around Europe. I mean, there's a guy whose name escapes me now who I shouldn't know. I think German guy who won't fly. He drives everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously you're not going to have much luck getting to the tournaments this week in Dubai, wherever they're playing, Abu Dhabi, or I'm not sure where they're playing this week, but it's a long way to drive to Australia, but you can easily drive the continent now.
Uh-huh.
But you're right. It's, if if you're not prepared to get into an aeroplane, it makes it a tough profession to really take full advantage of it.
Yeah, I remember there was a basketball player a few years back, Royce White or something. He had like a extreme phobia of flying, and you know, it cost him getting drafted very highly to, you know, moving back. And I think he's out of the league now. You know, it's like you gotta be able to fly if you want to be a professional athlete these days with all the travel. So tell me, you know, with the game, and you know, you've seen the change with technology from, you know, persimmon to metal woods to now today, where, you know, just, you know, the clubs are capped, but the ball just keeps getting better, and you know, the more and more courses are becoming vulnerable and scoreable. Like, how do you feel about kind of what's happening with the landscape of the game with technology and golf courses?
Well, I think it's a disaster. I mean, I just think that, you know, Australia doesn't have a long golf course anymore. I mean, every single golf course in Australia is obsolete. If the measure is how Alistair McKenzie and Alec Russell and the great designers down here wanted the golf courses to play. I mean, I watched the final of the Australian Amateur on Sunday. Minwoo Lee, who's Minji Lee's brother, was in the final, 17 years old. So the argument that these guys are better athletes, I mean, here's a 17-year-old boy who played the last hole at Yarra Yarra, which was always a short par five. In my day, it was a Bob Shearer was hitting five irons, and Greg Norman could perhaps get there with a six iron. It was a drive and a four iron for me. This kid drove it in the cross bunkers and then hit a nine iron out of the cross bunkers 20 yards over the green. I mean, it's a par five. The 16th hole was they played them as par fours during the week, but they played off the back tee at 16, you know, driving a wedge. So every golf course is obsolete. And you can't tell me he's not a better athlete as a 17-year-old boy than Greg Norman or Sam Snead or Jack Nicklaus were as 30-year-old men. So the argument that these guys are better athletes is, well, you know, partly it's, I mean, sure, they're fitter and stronger, but, you know, there are two things that matter in terms of the RNA's job and the USGA's job. I mean, they had two jobs. One was to protect or maintain the skill it took to play the game at the top level, and one was to protect the golf courses, and they've utterly failed at both of them, so that every kid who plays golf now who's half decent can hit the same drives but 30 yards longer than Nicklaus and Norman and Woozy and Seve hit. Mm-hmm. And don't tell me they're more skillful.
No.
And, you know, I mean, every decent golf course is obsolete. So you go to a place like Muirfield or Shinnecock and you look back at where those championship tees are, and it's just, I mean, it's laughable where some of those tees are at Muirfield. And I mean, the worst, you know, for me, the best golf course in the world is the old course at St Andrews. And the worst aspect of playing that golf course now is that almost on every single hole, you make the exact same walk back and to the right and walk back 60 yards mm-hmm. to these tees that are out of bounds or on the Eden course or the new course or the out of bounds in the case of the tee on the road hole, 17th hole. So, you know, it's just beyond dismaying that they've let the ball get so out of control. And seemingly to me, they've let the Titleist company, whose balls I've always played with and they've always made great golf balls, but, you know, it seems like the boss of Titleist runs golf, because as far as I can tell, they threaten lawsuits, and the RNA and the USGA are terrified of lawsuits. So here we have a manufacturer controlling, you know, the way the great golf courses in the world are played.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was the job of the administration to protect those golf courses against the ravages of the equipment. I mean, you can't protect them against small increases. And of course, they will argue on the record, not off the record, because they'll all admit they've screwed it up, but on the record, they'll say, well, they're only small increases, it's not really noticeable. Well, it's like saying a three-year-old kid who's 3 feet high, it's not really noticeable that he grows an inch a year, but he turns into a 6'6" man.
Yeah,
so it's
little
yeah,
increases
the same thing's
over a
happened with
long
the golf
time.
ball, is that, you know, sure, it's, you know, the larger that, well, you know, the distance increases aren't noticeable, but in the end, you watch a 17-year-old boy play the last hole at Yarra Yarra with a drive and a wedge. It's like, don't tell me the ball's not going further. I mean, you know, when Greg Norman was hitting 5 and 6 times in there, okay, I mean, that was considered. Because back in Peter Thompson's day, it was a drive and a three-wood or a four-wood.
Mm-hmm.
And back when Alec Russell built that golf course, it was a they were playing with hickory shafts, and it was two woods and a pitch.
Yeah.
So they've just dispensed with the second wood shot and turned it into a drive and a pitch hole, which is, you know, I played with Ryan Ruffles the other day at Royal Melbourne, and Ryan's the best kind of young player in Australia, and we played the West Course at Royal Melbourne, and pretty much every hole was a drive and a wedge for him. You know, it's one of the great golf courses in the world, and to watch a, you know, an 18-year-old, I mean, perhaps he's a little more than the boy, but not really, hit a wedge into pretty much every hole. The 17th hole was into the wind. He hit 3-iron, 5-iron, so I played a little longer. It was a 440-yard par 4, but, you know, if McKenzie came back now, he would just go ballistic at the people whose responsibility it was to protect his golf courses.
Yeah. I completely agree. I think it's a, you know, and these kids now that are coming up, their swings are built where they, you know, they've never seen a, you know, I grew up, and as a freshman in high school, I was hitting the ball like 200 yards. You know, these kids hit it 300 yards as freshmen, and their swings are built around, like, you know, the forgiveness of the clubs, and they never have a bad miss.
Well, the face is, you know, the face is so big, the shaft is so long and so light, and the ball goes straight because it won't spin. So, you know, it's all about how fast and hard you get the ball. It's all about power. So, mm-hmm. So not only does it destroy the golf courses, it drives out the inventive, shorter player.
So, if you were in charge of golf, how would you deal with kind of the problem? Would you do a rollback, or would you, you know, create a different type of equipment for, you know, the touring pros or high level amateurs? How would you approach it?
Well, I think you have to bifurcate the ball. Of course, they don't want that. But I mean, we had that forever. I mean, I grew up playing the small ball when the Americans played with the big ball. We played with the small ball. So the game was bifurcated for the longest time, for 40 or 50 years. And then we as top-level amateurs chose to play the big ball, because if we ever wanted to be pros, we knew we were going to have to play with it. So for 6 or 7 years, the pro tour in Australia and the top-level amateurs were playing the big ball, whilst the club players continued on with the small ball until the early 80s when they, you know, the small ball was banned. So people say that, Well, you can't, you know, change the ball and take this distance off the average amateur player. But I mean, they've already done that once, and no one really cared. I mean, no one even, because I actually don't think they would lose that much.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, with the stroke of a pen, and, you know, in 1983 or 84, when they banned the small ball in Britain and Australia, in theory, everyone that game lost 25 yards, because they went from playing a 1.6 ball to a 1.68 ball.
So do you think, outside of rolling back the ball, is there anything else you could do?
Well, I mean, the argument's always going to be that the amateurs want to play with what the pros use, but I mean, I would try and restore the skill it took to be a great driver. So you make a ball that's more difficult to drive far and straight, and you limit the size of the club head on the driver, which of course they should have done years ago but never did. So when the manufacturers figured out how to make a, you know, a head like a frying pan and make it light and make it so it didn't crack, then, you know, there was almost no limit on the size of the driver. So I would try and limit the size of the driver, but I understand. So really the ball's the thing to change. But, I mean, Seve was an advocate of everything you could have on a wedge. I mean, it's never going to happen, but I would say that every pro should have to use a Mizuno or a Titus or some sort of blade two iron or one iron. I mean, at least have one in their bag. So you're essentially, the guys who don't want to use it, you're making it a 13 type game, not a 14 type game. But I think if you want to be a professional player, something you can hit a proper two iron. I mean, this hybrid stuff is just junk for golf, you know, for top level pros. But that's kind of pie in the sky stuff, really. But the ball's the easiest and the main thing to fix. And if I was a good player, I'd be wanting to make the equipment as difficult to use as possible. And you know, the real problem, or, well, one of the problems with the game now has been kind of the complete decimation of career-type amateur golf. There are no career amateur players left anymore. I mean, every amateur tournament I go to, you know, certainly in Australia and Britain, it's just a bunch of kids who want to be pros. So because the equipment has given them all the same set of skills, they all look like they're really good players because the equipment makes them look like really good players. And some of them are, and some of them are just kind of faking it because the equipment makes them look good. So, you know, what the equipment has done is thrown thousands and thousands of kids into the pile of, you know, the same skill set, really. Whereas, you know, when I was growing up, the guys who could really drive the ball well, you know, the guys who could drive the Ballada ball with a persimmon driver well, I mean, Nicklaus and Woosnam and Seve, despite what people think, was a great driver. Norman, I mean, they had a huge, Weisskopf, they had a huge advantage because they were such powerful, long, straight drivers. And, you know, you either drove the ball like, you know, the guys I grew up admiring, like Peter Thompson, Graham Marsh, and Hale Irwin, you were, you know, a short, relatively short, straight hitter who dig the ball up and put it into play, or you were long and crooked, or you were long and great. Mm-hmm. But now everyone's long and straight, and you know, so the skill it takes to drive the ball has been utterly decimated by the equipment. And I would argue that it hasn't done the average player any good either, because the ball goes, you know, for them, you see so many more wildly crooked shots. You know, the club, you can swing so much harder at it, and the middle of the face is so much easier to hit. But if it's pointing in the wrong direction, the ball goes miles offline now.
Well, something I've found just bothers me is the length of the driver. You know, where you look at the average length of a tour driver, it's gone up 1 inch over the last, you know, 15 years. And somehow club manufacturers, because, you know, they've got a limit on their, you know, how they can construct a golf club, have decided to go after the average amateur player and do it by giving them more yardage by making a longer driver. But all that does is it makes it go longer and way worse directions. You know, if a longer driver meant longer and straighter drives, every PGA Tour player would be using it, but none of them do.
Was it Jimmy Walker that went back to a 42-inch driver in Hawaii or something?
Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, like, length is great, but you got to be in the fairway to score.
Yeah. So, you know, it sounds like we're a bunch of grumpy old men, you know, talking about the good old days, but.
I wish I was old. Yeah. I'm young.
Yeah.
I'm just grumpy.
Yeah, the average amateur player. I mean, they were, you know, the guys I caddied for, they didn't have very many good shots, but the first folks I caddied for were 25 handicappers, but they all hit the ball pretty straight. I mean, no one hit the ball. They would miss hit it a lot, but they never hit it really crooked. I mean, now you see the average amateur can hit the ball so far offline now, it's amazing, because the shafts are so long and, you know, they swing harder and it looks like you can swing away with impunity. And, of course, they'll hit three or four or five really good drives around, but boy, there are three of them just you don't find.
Yeah.
So, anyway.
It's,
let's get off the equipment.
So caddying. You caddied this year in the Olympics. Tell us a little bit about that experience and how, you know, what it was like, you know, being a part of representing your country.
Well, I'm not sure I was representing my country.
I mean, you had a part. You're part of the team.
I guess we kind of were. As a kid at my club, a girl called Sue O, who's a Korea, came to Australia when she was 8 years old, didn't play golf, and she played in the Australian Open when she was 12. I can remember watching her play. I watched her play a few holes, and this 12-year-old, you know, she wasn't a little girl. She was actually, you know, she was sort of 5'5" or something. But she was, it was this 12-year-old kid playing in the Australian Open. She qualified and she missed the cut, but not by many. And then she joined the club I played at about sort of 3 or 4 years later, I think. And we got to play a little bit, and she called me one night, and she'd been assigned a caddy for the Australian Open at Victoria about 2014. She said, "What should I do?" I said, "Why don't I caddy for you?" So I started to caddy for a little bit, and, you know, we did sort of 3 or 4 or 5 tournaments a year. And then last year she had a pretty lowly, she missed the top 25 on the LPGA Tour school in 2015, but she had a number that gave her some status, which was basically not much, but she was starting the Australian Open, and we did that, and she finished 14th, and she off her number, and she finished 40th there. Okay, for her there, so she re-ranked really well, and finished second at Kings Mill and eighth in the LPGA. Not Kay Webb, amazingly out of the Australian Olympic team. So she asked me to go to Kay for her down there, which was it was a lot of fun. It, you know, it was a really cool event. It was great to be a part of. It was fun to see her play in it. It was. Great to Gil Hance walked around the course with us on the first practice run we did, and so that was interesting. It was interesting for her to see, you know, how he thought about how he would design the holes, because obviously I was, I'm not sure how many 19-year-old young women are that aware of the strategy of golf. It's pretty much hit the ball where you're told to hit it and go from point A to point B, but sort of kind of growing up in Melbourne and played, knew there was more to golf than just seeing the ball straight. So, you know, we had a really cool day on Monday with Gil and walking around talking about the golf course and the angles. And, you know, there's a great old George Thomas quote about, Tom Simpson quote about the middle of the fairway being the ideal line for the hole. And, you know, sadly, many PGA Tour courses, the object is just to hit the fairway. It doesn't matter where you hit it, but you know, the fairway's narrow in line with high rough, and it's not the sort of golf I enjoy much. But, you know, Royal Melbourne, and of course the fairways are 60 or 70 yards wide, but you had to, you know, play the golf course really well. You had to play from the... So, you know, she had a good understanding of playing for the edges and opening up the angles. And so it was an interesting, fun 4 days to play the golf course. She played pretty well, really. She hit the, rarely if ever does she hit the wrong shot and the wrong club. And we got to the 13th hole on Sunday with not an unreasonable chance to go. She had to par 13, 14, 15 and birdie the last three. Birdie the last three was very possible given the nature of those holes. And 13 was the toughest hole, and she had a kind of a dodgy number. It was sort of between a 5-iron and a lofted hybrid. She hit the wrong club and for letting you hit it, because I kind of knew it was, and I should have stopped it. But, you know, I shoot over the back of the green, got a horrible line in the bunker and made six, and that was that. But she played well, finished 13th, and it was a really interesting week for her. It was a good confidence boost, and it was, she finished up the year 50th on the LPGA. We started the year pretty much not latest at all. So it was for me, it was a fun.
Yeah. It's interesting. You talked about the architecture and, you know, how width and being more about being on the correct side of the fairway as opposed to the, you know, just down the middle is kind of your belief. I think that that is so, you know, lost, and I think it, the angles is what, you know, made so many of these, you know, golden age courses great, and it's something that got kind of lost there in the middle. I feel like you, along with a lot of the new age architects, are trying to bring that back.
Well, yeah, you know, you can't have. Well, you can, but it's very difficult to create strategy if you don't have any width. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you look at the old course of St Andrews, which is basically two fairways wide with bunkers in the middle. And, you know, the National Golf Links and sort of Sand Hills in Nebraska, you know, the first great modern course, really. And you look at what Mike Kaiser's done at Bandon and out at Sand Valley, and what Gill did at Castle Stewart in Scotland, and, you know, some of the courses we've done here. You know, I love playing golf when you've got to work. And then you must hit the ball there, and if you don't, you get this. You get 6-inch rough on the side of the fairway and 6-inch rough around the greens. That's what you get. So as Seve said, you know, it's very, in his Spanish way, very mechanic type golf. And it is. You know, it's why Seve, you know, he was the only man who ever won at St Andrews, Augusta, and Royal Melbourne. And no surprise, given that, you know, it was Mackenzie's favourite course, and arguably his, certainly probably two of his best three courses, along with Cypress Point and perhaps Crystal Downs. But, you know, here was and you read the spirit of Andrews, and he loved it. Walter Hagen played golf, and here 50 or 60 years later was, you know, Walter Hagen reincarnated in Seve Ballesteros. So, you know, they played golf with flair and carefree abandon, and but you had to give them space to play. Mm-hmm. And if you didn't, you kind of blunted their skills. And sure, you could criticize Seve for not being, not having the game to win the US Open, and that's fine, because that was the preserve of someone like Hale Irwin, who played the perfect US Open game. You know, so, and that's the great thing about golf, is you can have a golf course and a championship that's set up to suit a Hale Irwin or a Ben Hogan or a Jack Nicklaus, but you can also have championships set up to suit someone like Ballesteros or Hagen, who needed more space. But once you gave him that space, it was a...
Yeah.
So the great thing about golf is that, you know, different golf courses show off different skill sets. And again, equipment, that's what's been with the... which really forces everyone to go the same way.
Yeah, I.
Because you can't. It's much more difficult to curve the ball, and you can't. You know, it's usually a powerful player. You know, so the game's utterly changed in the last 20 years, really.
Yeah, I completely agree. It's the, you know, the kind of art of working the ball and different ways of getting it done are diminishing every year. So. With your design firm that you guys started, so it's OCCM for short. It's you, Jeff Ogilvy, Mike Cocking, and Ashley Mead. Tell us a little bit about how you guys got together and started. Was it kind of just like minds, and how it got started, and you know, a little bit about this company.
Well, it was like minds. Well, I started off a business. Well, I didn't start it off. There were two of my partners in the original business, which was Michael Clayton Golf Design. With two superintendents in Melbourne, came to me and asked me if I was interested in starting off a business in design in 1995, and we did that. And we employed Michael and Ashley in 2000, I think, or 2001, pretty much around the same time. So that business survived until it didn't survive anymore in 2010. Uh-huh. You know, it was a sign of the times. It was the market really telling us that, you know, you need to run your business more efficiently. You know, we had sort of 15 years, really. And we had 1 year where, well, we can't pay the wages anymore. So we did the business went the way of the business. So I called Jeff and said, you know, this is the situation. We need some money. And he didn't even think about it he thought about it for a second, I think, and said, "Oh man, that's great." You know, so Jeff came on board. He sent us some money. He said, "Go start an office and let's get going." So we kind of started in 2010, and we picked up one really good job almost immediately at a place called Bonnie Doon in Sydney, which was a big redo, which we're about to we're about to open the stage three in about 2 months, which is we've got three holes to do in stage four, so we're opening sort of five holes in a month. So, you know, we got that job and we sort of bombed along and got a few more. We beat Greg Norman to get a big commission to beat to Rimba Royal Canberra, which was the best inland course in Australia. So that was a nice job to get. We've kind of done pretty well since, really. I think we've done some good work with. I mean, really, people. Jeff Ogilvy, when they think about our business, thinking about me a little more, but I mean, that would underrate the tremendous talents of Mark and Ashley, who are really. I mean, Jeff one day a few years ago came to me and said, "We'd be screwed without these guys, wouldn't we?" I said, "Yeah, we would." So, you know, you look at every really good design business around the world now, and you know, whether it's Gil Hans or Tom Doak or Bill Kaur and Ben Crenshaw, but there are really talented people who work for those guys who make them and us all look really good. So it would be an incredibly simplistic thing to look at the names of the people at the top of the letterhead and think they were the ones who were doing all the work and they were the ones that were really responsible for the work, because it goes much deeper than that. And,
yeah.
You know, if you spoke to Bill Kaur, he would tell you all the guys who make him look really good. And he's, you know, I think you can make an argument that Bill is one of the great designers of all time, you know, if not the greatest. You know, I think at this point, if you were going to put one guy up against McKenzie and Tillinghast and Ross, then it'd be Bill Kaur, because he's a, you know, look at the courses that he and Ben have done. They've really transformed the modern game, I think. And Sandhills was a breakthrough golf course. It showed everyone what to do. And, you know, any modern architect who hasn't studied the Sandhills is, you know, their education is sort of deficient in one sense. And, you know, I was lucky enough to play Sand Valley, which is the new course they've just done out in Wisconsin. And, you know, in some ways I was talking to Mark Cockney about today was, you know, in some ways it's when you talk about Kaur and Crenshaw courses, it's you could say, well, they're all kind of the same, but, and in a sense they are, but yeah, they're all the same. They're just all great. And,
yeah.
And yeah, you can recognize that look and the type of golf they like and the type of golf they build. And, if you were going to be critical of them, which I'm certainly not, you could say, well, you've seen one, you've seen a few of them. But you know, every single course you go to, well, you can see that Bill and Ben have done it, but they're all tremendous, tremendous golf courses. And you can say the same about Alistair McKenzie, really. I mean, Augusta, I mean, people talk about, you know, there's this stupid line in Australia that, you know, such and such a golf course is Australia's Augusta, and it used to be Royal Canberra because it was hilly and it had pine trees, and it was there's a course in northern New South Wales that people call Australia's Augusta because it's got green grass on it, I think. But as Tom Doak said, Augusta's Royal Melbourne's the course Augusta wants to be. So Augusta is almost America's Royal Melbourne. That's the way I kind of look at it. But, the lessons of golf design are timeless, really. I mean, you look at Royal Melbourne, Augusta and St Andrews, and you know, I think people, you know, the guys who are doing really good work now look at those courses and study them and understand them and try and replicate the things that make those courses great. And the great modern courses are throwbacks to that era, really.
Yeah, I think I echo your thoughts about Kaur and Crenshaw. Sand Valley was unbelievable. That's a great new golf course. And then I just got done playing Stream Song Red, and I thought that was fantastic. I mean, the way I just love the way they are able to blend playability, and then, you know, I noticed like all the, you know, it's all about angles and, you know, being the ideal line for somebody that's looking to score is always along, you know, there's a risk to taking that line. And you can always bail out right, but then you have just usually a very, very difficult shot to get back and, you know, to have a birdie chance. And it's amazing when you start to play them and you start to realize, like, you know, the ideal line on this hole is a, you know, 480-yard par four is right hugging a, you know, is hugging the left side of the fairway where there's a 30-foot bunker, you know? And sure, you can you've got 60 yards to bail out right, but then you've got just an awful angle into a green that slopes away. And it's just brilliant. It's, you know, it's special, you know, when you can start to see that.
Yeah, and it's not, Bill would be the first to admit, I mean, this is not rocket science, this stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just replicating the 7th pole at Royal Melbourne or the road hole at St Andrews, or, you know, it's not like they've discovered anything new. It's just, you know, they put it beautifully on the ground and, you know, they choose projects where the land is great, that they just build great golf, and it's not anything genius or anything new. It's just, you know, it's just beautiful golf they build, and it's great fun to play in.
Yes.
You know, I mean, Friars Edge is a tremendous golf course. I've played there a couple of times, and it's a beautiful place to play golf. And, you know, I wonder whether they really care about, you know, the modern young player who's the ball 320 yards. I mean, I suspect Bill would throw his hands up and say, well, I'm glad I'm not trying to design golf courses for those guys.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, as Jeff said many times, he said, why would you want to design a course for us? Because no one would want to play it. And it's true. I mean, who wants to play a golf course that's going to test those guys because no one else can play it? And who wants to play a golf course where there are tees back there that are 80 yards back and everything's out of scale and nothing seems quite right because there are these, you know, where do we play from? I mean, it's you know, again, it goes back to the disaster of the ball and what it's done to the game. And, you know, I kind of like the fact that Mike Kaiser and Bill and Ben and, you know, Gil don't really care about how you know, the young, modern, strong player plays the game, because it's not, you know, they're not designing courses for those guys. They're, you know, designing fun courses for the rest of the people who play golf. But I always think the game would be more fun for the young kids if they could play the golf courses much more like the way we play them.
Mm-hmm.
But they can't, because, you know, you go back to the Australian Amateur again. I mean, it was a pitch and putt final, really.
Mm-hmm. Hey, we got a ton of Twitter questions, and I definitely want to get to them because, you know, we just got a lot of great ones here. And a lot of them are based around architecture. So I think it'd be good to dive in here, and it can, some of them are on your projects. From Tony Deere, what's the latest on 7 Mile Beach, and what's the schedule at Shady Oaks?
Well, 7 Mile Beach is the course in Hobart we were talking about. So, you know, it's one of those things that you just kind of sit and wait, and you hope that the guy who's going to do it's going to do it.
Uh-huh.
And I think we're all pretty hopeful he is. So we're sitting and waiting and wanting for the client to say, yep, let's go and do it. But so that's where that one's at.
Uh-huh.
Shady Oaks, we're doing the Hogan's kind of little practice course, little 9-hole course in the middle of the golf course where Hogan used to go and practice, which was a really rudimentary par 3 course with one short par 4 and, I mean, just little basic round greens with shapeless bunkers. And so we did 3 holes last year, and as we speak, we're shaping the 6 remaining holes. So it's kind of a, you know, with some really cool, I mean, nothing sort of flashy bunkers, but, you know, some well-shaped bunkers, some cool greens, some, with the idea that it's still a 9-hole par 3 course, but you can really go out and throw a bag of balls down anywhere and play great shots to any green, and you can play great holes from wherever you choose to play them from. So the 9th was a kind of a par 3 across a kind of a gouged out sort of creaky barranca thing in front of the green. But we're building a tee on the other side of the 4th fairway, mm-hmm. to create what is a really cool 360-yard par 4 with a great, you know, perfectly placed fairway bunker and a really cool hole to place. So when the course is not busy, you know, if you want to go out and practice your drives or go and play a hole, you know, a really cool hole, you can do that. So the idea is to have the golf limited only by your imagination, really. So throw balls down anywhere and hit shots to any green, and plus it's a course where you could take any 6 or 7 or 8 year old kid and teach them how to play golf.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's no reason why you couldn't learn to be a tour class player playing only those 9 holes, but because there'll be every shot you can imagine to play.
I think that
apart from playing shots out of long grass, which there'll be none of that. So you might have to learn how to play out of long grass by going somewhere else. But you know, it's a really cool place to practice and a cool place to play. And then they closed the main course to rebuild it in 2019 is the plan. So they'll just shut the main course for a year and we'll rebuild it.
That's cool.
So it's a, you know, it's a cool place to work. I mean, when Ben Hogan died, he left every club he had to the club pro there, Mike Wright. I mean, there are 900 clubs lying around that, well, not lying around that golf club, but in racks and sitting around the pro shop, and it's such an amazing place to go, really, and just look around at the history of that place is incredible. So it's a fun place to work. And Bruce Devlin's a member there who, you know, he was one of my, you know, along with Peter Thompson, he was the, you know, they were my two heroes when I was a 12-year-old kid. I mean, you would go and watch, they were the two guys to watch in Australia play golf, and Devlin would come out and play in Australia every year, and I watched him play a lot of golf, and I played with him when I was an amateur in the Australian Open, sort of 10 years after I first watched him play in the Australian Open at Kingston Heath. And so, you know, it's kind of cool to go back there and meet him as a, I want to say he's an old man, he's probably 80 years old, but he looks tremendous for his age. And, you know, it's a funny journey through life that you know, you've kind of come across someone who was your boyhood hero, really. And here he is, a member of the golf club that you're going to dig up and rebuilds. So in a sense it's fun, and in a sense it's a pretty big responsibility not to mess it up.
Yeah, I mean, that's so cool. I love the concept with the 9-hole course. I think that is exactly what golf should be. I was talking to somebody who runs a first tee program, and I was saying how, you know, their facilities should just be places with wall-to-wall fairways and a few greens, yeah, bunkers, and just let the kids learn how to get the ball in the hole and tee it up wherever they want and play, you know, golf that way.
Yeah. And it's really the dream practice field. I mean, Sue's a member there. And you know, from the seventh tee, you can hit a straight sort of 7-iron shot, but you can stay on that tee and hit a long draw into the second green and a long fade into the third green. You know, sort of 170 or 80 yard shots or 90 yard shots. So you can stand there for hours and practice, you know, the three basic shots in golf, the straight shot, the draw shot, and the fade shot. And, you know, you're playing shots in a beautiful greens, it's a beautiful environment. And it's really, as I said, there's no reason why, you know, a kid couldn't learn to be a scratch player just playing that 9-hole golf course, because there'll be every shot they want.
Mm-hmm. That's cool. So, question from Nick Mackey. What's the trend in modern design you'd like to see it go away? And what's your favorite course in Oz outside of Melbourne? So I assume that's Australia, right?
The trend in modern design you'd like to see go away. Well, I'm huge on modern design. I think you could argue that since Sandhills has been the most productive period of golf course design ever. I'm perhaps even better than the golden age from, 1913 to 1930 Augusta, really. So, you know, certainly I think it rivals it. So, you know, I'm huge on the quality of modern design. I mean, I think that in terms of modern television golf, the curse of long grass, I don't think that golf is best played out of long grass. I mean, it's what tour pros want, because they want predictability of punishment. They want to know that if someone hits the ball offline, they get the same punishment they do for the same shot. And, you know, I mean, golf's much more fun when the punishment is random. And dealing with the unfairness of golf, or the lucky break, or the good or the bad break, is, I mean, that's the whole mental challenge of the game. So, you know, I think that pro golfers sanitize the game down to a point where you know, it's really a test of execution as opposed to a test of thought and execution. So modern televised golf, you know, if I was going to change that, I would change the emphasis on fairness and the use of long grass to create an equity of punishment, because I don't think the best courses do that. You know, I think golf is much more random than that. My favourite course in Australia outside of Melbourne, the course of Bumboogle, the Bill Coors course at Lost Farm, and the course we did with Tom Doker, courses I've got a great affection for. The courses outside of... tricky. It's a tricky question for me, because we've been lucky enough to work in the best course in Perth, the best course in Brisbane, and one of the best two or three courses in Sydney. So it's difficult to answer that question without nominating one of our own courses. But let me pick a course in New Zealand. Apart from Paraparam Beach, which is a course Alec Russell did, there's a really cool course called Arrowtown in Queenstown. Now, Queenstown has become a bit of a centre of high-end expensive golf. It's, I think, the Jack's Point and the Hills are probably green fees somewhere between $200, $300, or $400. I think the Hills is $500, but mm-hmm. Jack's Point might be $200. But there's a really cool little course called Arrowtown, which is right down the road from the Hills, which is about $40 a round, and it's a tremendous little course. So anyone who goes to the South Island of New Zealand, go to Arrowtown. It's one of the most unique golf courses in the world. So if I was to pick a favourite golf course outside of Melbourne in Australia, let me pick Arrowtown in New Zealand, which is kind of cheating, but anyone who happens to go to Queenstown, do not miss playing at Arrowtown, because you can get 10 rounds for the price of one. And I promise you, you'll have 10 times more fun. It's a really, it's a much overused word, unique, but it's a truly unique golf course. And, it's a course that everyone should see.
That's awesome. I love that it's a great value. It's finding those gems are the most fun. Yeah. You know, playing the best courses are great, but when you find like a really great little unique gem that nobody knows about, that's really great, I think that's the most fun about discovering golf courses. Let's go with here. Which course would you most like to renovate or restore?
In Australia?
Anywhere.
Anywhere? That's another interesting question. If someone had asked me that question, people did ask me that question often, and always the answer was Royal Canberra. So normally my answer would be Royal Canberra, except that we did get the chance to do that, and we opened it. Jeff and I opened it the Monday of the Australian Open this year. So that was always my stock answer, but we actually got to do that once. So let me come back to that one. I'll think about it over the next 5 minutes and come back with a better answer then. Because all of the great courses in Britain that I really loved, there wasn't one that you ever went to and thought, wow, this would be a great course if you could only fix it. There were many examples in Australia of courses that I thought this would be a really good course if you could fix it. And we've been lucky enough to have the chance to fix a few of them. But not every member would say that. But, I would use that fix adjective.
Yeah.
But, you go to Britain and you see, how many great golf courses there are in England. And you think, I never came across a course there where, perhaps one, Wentworth. Let me throw in Wentworth in there because that was a Harry Colt course that, got derailed. We're not going to get the job at Wentworth, but I think if someone could, for want of use of a better cliche, make Wentworth great again, that would be a pretty cool job to do for someone. I'm not sure who's going to do that, but Wentworth would be Now, in terms of English golf courses, that would be right at the top of the list.
Yeah, it's, you know, players don't even like playing there, it seems like. So here's an interesting question from Chris. Why is it, and I know he goes down to Australia almost every year, why is it that nowhere else can seem to replicate the Australian sand belt bunkering? And for those that don't know or are familiar with it, he says greens bleed in right into the bunkers without fringe, and the faces of the bunkers are very hard.
Well, you can replicate the taking of the very edges of the greens to the bunkers. I mean, certainly in lots of places you can do that, not everywhere. But I mean, the thing about sandbelt bunkers, I mean, I think it's a unique combination of the type of the sand and the soil that they're built out of, and how the couch grass roots hold the lips together. But yeah, my answer to that question would be, I don't think you want to. And I've seen people try and replicate sandbelt bunkers in other places, and it doesn't really work. I think Gil got really close in Rio and did a great job and built beautiful bunkers down there. And I know he based them on the sandbelt bunkers, but he didn't try and, you know, exactly replicate them, because I think attempts at trying to replicate that look, I mean, they all fail. Mm-hmm. You know, they just don't work very well. So I'm kind of a supporter of leaving sandbelt bunkers to Melbourne and not trying to replicate that look, because I think, you know, they really work well in Melbourne but don't work that well anywhere else. And perhaps you can kind of, I mean, people try and build them and try and get that look, but it's never quite the same. So I think that, you know, we don't try and replicate it anywhere else but in Melbourne. Mm-hmm. So, and we're pretty good at doing them, I think. So for other people to try and replicate them is not a great idea, because it's very difficult to do and it never really works.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think you can replicate the principles of them, but trying to replicate the exact look doesn't really work. But one thing that's really, you know, works, I mean, the Metropolitan where I play is, you know, people marvel at the fact there is literally no fringe at all. And we're rebuilding the two courses at Peninsula now, and, you know, the edges of the greens go right to the very edge of the bunkers, and it's a really cool feature, and it works really well. But you don't see it anywhere else in the world, really. And it's, you know, where it's possible to do it, it's really worth trying to do.
Yeah, it's. I imagine a lot of the soil. It's so much goes into that. Let's do some kind of rapid fire questions that are parts of all these questions we got here. So. How do you like template holes?
I think every hole is a copy of something.
Yeah.
Largely, you know, unless you're finding a really unique form of land. I mean, I enjoyed, you know, the National Golf Links, I suppose, was the first template golf course, you know, with all those holes that McDonald went and copied from Britain. So I think they work really well. You know, if you do them well, they're tremendous to play. So, you know, the quintessential dogleg left hole in Australia is the 17th at Royal Melbourne, with the bunker on the inside corner, and, you know, the big of the drive, and, you know, the big bunker coming across the front right of the green, and the green where every yard you drive away from the hazard on the left, you know, a yard harder to the second shot, and that hole is replicated all over Melbourne. The 15th at Metropolitan, the second at Spring Valley. There are a whole bunch of holes at Melbourne that are replicas of the 17th at Royal Melbourne. So, you know, I think if you're designing, we're always thinking of holes we've played before and holes we like and holes that work. And, so I think in terms of what we do and what other designers do, I think they're always replicating the principles of the great holes. So, you know, the road hole at St Andrews is a dogleg to the right, really, with the bunker on the front left of the green. But, you know, it's really not much different from the, you know, it's a flip of the 7th. Well, the 7th at Royal Melbourne is a flip of the road hole, really. You know, again, it's drive it down the boundary line, and every yard left of the boundary line you go, a yard more problematic a second shot. So, you know, it goes back to what we were talking about before, about there being nothing new in golf course design, really. And mm-hmm. you know, I played a course this morning at Portsea, which is a really fun course out of Melbourne with some incredibly unique landforms and holes you won't see anywhere else. But, you know, in the end, if you've got a standard-ish sort of piece of land, then you're always going to replicate the principles of the great holes.
Yeah.
So template holes work pretty well, really, for me.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's you get in trouble when you try and reinvent the wheel, right?
Yeah. Yeah, you do.
Who would you say is the most underappreciated architect?
Well, in Australia, Alec Russell was, who was Australian Open champion. He was a wealthy kind of grazier, really, and he worked in politics a little bit. But he was Mackenzie's partner down in Australia. He did the East Course at Royal Melbourne, Yarra Yarra, Lake Karen up in Paraparaumu in New Zealand. So he didn't do many golf courses. He was really a part-time architect in a sense, but he did some tremendous work down here. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Russell was great in this part of the world. I mean, I'm not sure if Tom Simpson's underrated, but I mean, Moorfontein is, you know, it'll be one of my, you know, top 5 or 10 days out playing golf in the world. It's an incredible golf course that Simpson did. So Simpson's perhaps is, you know, someone who doesn't get due credit for the greatness of his work, but, you know, I always love playing his courses.
I heard there's a new book out about Simpson that's really good. I haven't had
the Yeah, there is. Yeah, it's good. Out. Yeah.
What of the courses you've designed, which are you most proud of? And that's from Alistair.
We did Bamboogle with Tom and Tom Doak, and I think, you know, that's been a pretty successful development and a fun course to play. But the courses we've done on our own, mostly our work's been redesigned. We've done a couple mm-hmm. Ranfurly was a new golf course, and Royal Queensland was basically a new golf course. They lost 6 holes, and we basically rebuilt the entire golf course on that original piece of land. But, you know, it's easy to just sort of alert to the last job you did. But, I mean, I thought we did a great job at Royal Canberra. I think that was it was a very pretty place to play golf. It was a nice environment. The course was in good condition. But in truth, I never thought it was much of a golf course. It was once rated 5th in Australia, and I think it had kind of slid down the rankings to about where it should have been, which was about 50 or 60. And a friend of mine who is a young kid, but who lived, he spent 6 months at St Andrews University last year doing part of his engineering degree over there. Golf course, now that he's a lot, and he's thought about golf courses a lot, and he played Royal Canberra the other day, and he rang up driving out the gate and said, "Wow," he said, "it's really good." So, you know, it's always nice to get the opinion of someone who's seen it for the first time and who actually got it. And, you know, I think we did a pretty good job there. So I would say, the work we've done, I think Royal Canberra was a really good job and turned out really well.
That's cool. It's always nice, I'm sure, to hear praise from somebody that's got a good eye for golf courses.
Yeah, yeah.
Last question. Really appreciate all the time. If you had 5 courses that you could play the rest of your life, and, you know, obviously location, you know, assume all 5 are in your backyard, what 5 would they be?
5 courses. Moorfontein, I would play. I would play Woking. I would play Sandhills. I would play the National Golf Links, and I would play Royal Melbourne. How's that for 5? I mean, that's kind of the unanswerable question, but you try and create as much
variety
in the golf. Well, that's ridiculous because I leave out the old course. I can't leave out the old course. So Jimmy six, and the old course would be number one. But you know, I love playing golf at Moorfontaine because it's the most beautiful clubhouse in the world. And we have a drink in Australia, which I haven't had for years, orange juice and lemonade. And you know, it was a drink I had a lot when I was a kid. And I played with Billy Longmuir, a great friend of mine who played the European Tour for years. We went to Moorfontaine. It was a hot day, and for some reason, we went to this into the bar, and I said, "Do you have orange and lemonade?" And this little French lady who just happened to be behind the bar reached down under the bar, pulled out an orange, cut it in half, hand squeezed it, and poured it with lemonade. And it's like, a couple does that, that's going to be the best place in the world to play golf. So, yeah. So Moorfontaine, the old course. I mean, I'll probably give you a different answer now, but Moorfontaine, the old course, Woking, because it's such an understated, cool little golf course. It's great fun. Sandhills, because it's the great modern course. The National Golf thing is because it was the first great course in America. And I can't remember the last one. Oh,
Royal Melbourne.
Royal Melbourne, because I've, you know, because it was where I, you know, I watched all the great players play there. I played a lot of tournaments there. I'm still, you know, it's the one course that I played there last week, and it's the one course I can play after 45 years and still, I'm in awe of the golf course, and I'm kind of in awe of the fact that it's in my backyard, really.
Yeah.
And it's literally in Jeff Ogilvie's backyard. If you hit a long hook off the 14th tee on the West Course, you land in Jeff Ogilvie's house. So he, you know, he's the luckiest guy in the world. He literally jumps the back fence and plays the back paddock at Royal Melbourne. So there aren't many cooler places to live than that.
Yeah, seriously. It's I'm guessing you're still learning little things about the course every round around. It's that's usually the sign of a great course, right?
It is. Yeah, it is.
It's all right. Well, hey, you know, I want to get you out of here. I know it's probably midnight there now, and I really appreciate the time. You're a great guest, and we'll have to have you on again. I feel like we only scratched the surface about the things we could talk about.
Okay, thanks, Andy. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, definitely. And thanks again. Bye.
Thanks, mate.